Township. The subjects talked about included threshing in the old days, raising of sheep, his experiences as a the old local party line telephone system, experiences growing up on a farm in Branch County approximately between the years of 1900 and 1950. In the old days, and yet they've I know all the old records my grandfather had. He was keeping sheep back in those early days, and you don't see them. You have any anymore?
No, I sold them all here about 3 years ago. Thought I might want to go some warmer place in the winter, and I haven't never been able to get Ma started to go to some warmer place in the winter, so I might just walk that sheep. But they made me some good money. I turned them into corn fields after we harvested the corn. And I never kept them inside. Always fed them out in the field. And I always predicted that some trying to go in would come along someday. And having to let this was fool the animals. Because they wouldn't understand that sheep are healthier outdoors than they are indoors. And I never forgot the Sunday morning that I went over. Of course, I always used to be pretty good, you know. He'd take the rams out and have the lambs in May after it sheared the sheep, and didn't have to pay attention to them. And I'd forget to get the rams out. Went over there one February morning, and I had 27 newborn lambs in a blizzard. I thought, oh my God. Your old Ma said, going to church. And I said, no, I'm not going to church. I got a job. Went back over there and I opened the barn doors and I took two sacks of oats and made a trail. Because I knew I couldn't drive him in. I thought maybe I could coax him in. Then I went down and I drove that 200 head of ewes up to the barn. Probably took me 2 hours and I put near froze that I was carrying lambs and cussing and got them up there. I said, well, at any rate, those are lambs, will stay. Went back at night. There was a half a mile back in the farm. But I never lost a lamb.
That's great.
They lived right through it.
What was the maximum number of brood ewes you had? You had quite a flock.
Well, probably maximum 250. I always tried to keep around 200. But you used to make pretty good money on it, because as long as the fall, when people would sell cheap dogs, you know, and they could buy old ewes for all the way from $4 to $6 a head, and the lambs would bring $20 a head. When I look at the price up and down, I wonder why they ain't got some now.
Yeah.
But they, I never drained them, except the lambs, and sometimes not very much on them. But they did all right for me.
You said your grandfather built the old house down here?
He built this one too.
Built this one. And your parents lived here? This where you were raised?
Yeah. I was born on the next farm north, the Dave Logan house. But, never was there when about 6 months when we moved down here. See, Granddad owned where the next house is down there, and where Father's was down here. He had the whole chunk in here, and that was all divided up.
What were particularly interested in this grain harvesting deal? How much grain did you grow here? Showing us the passion for.
Tell you, Hale, I don't know if we ever kept track. We were limited, of course, to how much you could get in. There were three old plug horses.
You farmed with three horses?
Oh, yeah, and a single bottom plow. And we always diversified. We had oats and we had wheat. And, that helped us a bit, because, but I can well remember we almost never got the corn in until about 1st of June. We aimed for Decoration Day, but we missed it a lot of times. And Dad always insisted on going to Reed Jello Dance. That was about 110-day corn. Now, a lot of times, she sat down there in the shop and froze in the winter. You take a log chain down and feed my horses and throw a log chain on each shock and cut it loose. Put it in the cutter or get it up the house. And if it wasn't ripe, we had to throw it down to the furnace. Let it fall out and carry it out to the house for
you. I was going to ask you out there in the barn. You said that was your thrashing floor. Did you store all your wheat and oats, or what did you store in that thrash?
Well, the wheat almost always went to the barn. Of course, early years. Later years, after we got our own rig so we could depend on the thrashing rig, why, we thrashed it out of the field.
But before that, you put it in the barn?
Before that, we put it in the barn.
Did you thrash the oats and wheat at the same time, then?
Yeah, you couldn't get a thrasher on about once in a blue moon, so you had to have a pretty decent job to get them to come. That again was one reason for buying the rig.
Who was your thrasher before you bought the rig?
Whaley.
Where was he out of, you know?
Out of Quincy. Ray Whaley. His descendants are still in town. He had, of course, one of my earliest recollections was when he was going down 112. Had the old steam engine, and then the separator, and then the water tank, and then the bunkhouse, all took along.
He carried a bunkhouse.
How many How many men did he bring with him?
They always figured 12 to 14.
He brought them all?
For a full rig, yeah.
Well, what did those men do? That's a new one to me.
Oh, they slept in the bunkhouse, and they handled all your grain. That is, they pitched it in, took care of the grain, they did everything. But, as I say, it was kind of hard to get them. And one reason I remember them was my uncle, Josh Albright, had one of the first cars, old four-cylinder Chevy. And he was passing that long rig down on 112 and met a car from the other direction. And Uncle Josh was always for lawsuits when he was down in Indiana. He lived in Fremont before he moved to Quincy. And he always won his lawsuits, but he didn't win that one. Uncle Josh said, by Gaddy, he said that was a straight road, and there was a crookeder road in the country. But I was trying to find out. There's only two living people besides myself. One is Flossie Patton, and the other one is Lily Moore. Lily Moore lives up in Traverse City. I called Flossie, asked her if she knew when the thrashing rig was first formed. She couldn't remember. But I think just about the time I got out of school. I think the first year I was still in school, which would make it about 1918. And they just started and took in everybody on the road, pretty much. We had Bill Potter, Oscar Van Patten, Louis Moore, R.B. Gilbert, A.E. Lampman, George Hartman, Fay Moore, Earl Sprout, Fred Lampman, and us. Later on, they included Warren Joseph and Albert Banker, but that was quite a lot later when they were having trouble getting the thrashing done. But there were 10 in the original outfit.
What did they buy? What did this original outfit buy?
We had a Waterloo Boy tractor. You ever seen one of them? I was surprised here 2-3 years ago when the Smithsonian Institute, and that's the first thing I saw when I got in the door.
Is that right?
It was a Waterloo Boy tractor. They had a green job, mounted crossways of the frame, the engine was. And they had a big cast iron crank. And we cranked it with. George Hartman said, well, we had George Hartman and Louis Moore. George Hartman had the best set of false teeth you ever saw. Louis Moore had the poorest. Louis, you could hear him click, 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 click. And George, he looked just like it was his own. So somebody asked him one day, George, how come you got such a nice bit on your teeth? And he said, the dentist told me that put those in my mouth and leave them there. And he said, until that darn tractor hit and knocked them out, they stayed there.
Any idea what system was for each of the 10 men?
Golly, I don't know. We bought an advanced Romley Red River Special separator. They were made over the Battle Creek. And this old tractor.
What size cylinder on a separator?
I think it was 38 inch.
Pretty good size separator.
Yeah, pretty good size separator. And steel wheel, of course, on everything. Spade lugs on the tractor, which is fine, except when you get the sand on the road. Then you have a time. But we got along with it.
How did you take care of the running of it, looking after the tractor?
Well,
like
each man on his job was supposed to say, well, you run the separator and you run the tractor. But of course, the way it turned out, usually, why, they started out with somebody that was pretty good with the tractor running the tractor, and somebody else that was pretty good on the separator running the separator, and they kind of kept through it through the season.
The cooperative, each man runs each fireman.
Oh, yeah, and they had a set rule that you had to speak, and you couldn't go by anybody if they were ready to trash. For instance, if the first man ready was down the next house here, we started there. And if I was ready, when they came by, they couldn't pass me up. If I wasn't, who was ready down the line to take me?
Oh, yeah.
But it was a good rule. And then eventually, combines came in, and we bought one of those big tractor full John Deere combines.
You know about what year that would be? Roughly?
Years I don't. We had that 10-foot combine, which was miserable to set up. We had to, of course, we took it apart and trailed the 10-foot. That had a canvas belt that carried the stuff up into the thrashing part. But I wouldn't say that was ever the best thing in the world. And we had to have put our outfit, so we built a shed.
Where was that?
It was over on Faymore's, right across from the George Hartman place, right in the corner of Faymore's farm.
It was over here in the old grain zone, wasn't it?
Well,
just east of
no, it was down on Jonesville Road.
Oh, yeah.
Faymore's is just north of Jonesville Road, and his farm come up to both corners. And it was on the southeast corner of his farm that we built the shed. Well, then when he finally sold his farm, we had to move the shed. Because we didn't have any legal papers or anything. It said we could hold the land. So we had to move the tractor shed, and now it sits over here on Earl Sprouse. It's pretty dilapidated, but it sits over there on Earl Sprouse on the west side of the road. And pretty well gone to pieces. But it served its purpose pretty well.
What did he tell you pay for thrashing? Do you have any idea about
it? We paid the going rate.
Do you have any idea what he started and what the going rate might have been?
Well, roughly, I'd say probably 3 cents for oats and uh, five six for wheat, five for wheat, usually six for rye. That's bushel. And of course, I've always had a measure right on the rig.
Well, did it solve your problems? Was that it?
Did a pretty good job. Yeah, we didn't lose a lot of grain, because you couldn't be over 9 men ahead of you. Well, when you had the old rig that came down the road, there might be 50 ahead of you. And on a wet year, why, the grain is blowing right out of the top of the shocks. It was all green. You're taking a lot of loss.
Well, was there any problems with this neighborhood?
None that were too... None that were insurmountable, let's put it that way. The young folks, this was kind of an automatic. Everybody said where everybody worked. And the young folks always carried grain. And we carried a bushel and a half of wheat and sausage on our shoulders. And many carried up the stairway. A lot of grainers were under the stairway. Go up the top of the stairs and drop it down in. This was a way of conserving space. And if it was a long haul, why, we'd lift it up and put it on a wagon. We used to have a contest to see who could pull a bushel and a half of wheat up there with one hand. And then we were not so smart that we was putting them up without using our hands at all. We would drift the top of the bag with your feet, pick it up and toss it up with your knee.
That's hard on the teeth.
That was part of the fun. All of our grain here, we never had a binder. But father's had a four horses on an old deer and corn binder. I mean an old deer and grain binder. And this used to be the test of how good you were if you could bring a good piece of grain and set it up fast enough so you picked the last bundle off in the bundle carrier when he got done. And more often you didn't than you did. I'm reminded of that this morning. I was picking stone back here and the Amish were just over the fence. And I had some rock down there and I thought, and it was sprinkling. I didn't have a coat and the wind was cold. And I was wet and I was cold and I wanted to get done. And I thought, sure as heck that guy will think I want to talk to him because there was a bunch of stone right along the fence that I had to pick up. And sure enough, he had five horses on a four-section drag. And they plowed it early when it was wet. And he had a plank across that drag and he was standing on the plank trying to hold the drag in and driving the horses. And of course he wanted to talk and the rest of his horses. I wouldn't want to talk. So I excused myself as soon as I could and went on picking stone, but brought back memories. He asked me if I still milk cows and I said, no. I said, the last day I milked cows was when we milked them this way. I never thought that they're still milking them that way today.
That's right.
How did you shock grain? You mentioned driving the last bundle off the body with a long shock?
Long shock. We always put them in long shocks. Yeah. A dozen in a shock.
You never used calves on shock.
Never used calves. When I tested cows in 22, I had experience with round shocks. A fellow up in Vermontville had a heck of a good piece of wheat. Also had a lot of candy pickles in it, but he was short of help. And he had two other fellows and myself. And I said, well, I don't know anything about this round shot business. I said, I'll set up the first six, because you set them up just the same as you would alone. The next fellow, they four up against your six. And the last fellow put two on the calf. It was my own bargain, but I never made a worse one. That wheat was full of candy pistols, and it was big. And at 4 o'clock, I had to get to the next job and go to testing. And I was glad to get away. One of the things that we always used to do was see who could get the most bushels of grain out of all the grain from the field. And in order to do that, the boys that were the most expert need every bundle. Now, I don't know whether you don't know what I mean by needing every bundle. Of course, later on, everybody handled it with a pitchfork. And they'd stand on the rack and place them around with a pitchfork. But the old timers took them and they put the knee down on every bundle that was put up. And they packed her down in there, and it wasn't uncommon to get from 100 to 115. 20 bushel of oats in one load. But you wanted a good team.
I was going to say. And, you're sure.
Speaking of good teams, I always remember the time that Earl Sprout had the team of mules, and Charlie Potter, every time Earl said, whoa, the mules went about 6 feet farther and then stopped. And Charlie said, my gosh, Earl, I think you would teach those mules how to stop when you say whoa. Then Earl says, you try driving them. So Charlie took the mule. We came up and we were back right up to the barnyard fence. And blowing the straw over the fence. So Charlie took a piece of baling wire and put it over the top of the head and down across it from the mouth and fastened the lines to the baling wire. And they came up to the separator, and when he said, whoa, he leaned back into those lines, and the mule jumped the fence.
Incidentally, on this old fashioned machine, did you ever hear your family say anything about a man having to lie up on the cotton machine and cut the bands?
No, we always did on the corn treader.
On the grain.
On the grain, no, they always had a band cutter. Of course, that's another thing, it was an art. You pitched one of those funnels in the crossways, and that old summer said, boom! Whoever was running the separator told you that wasn't the way to pitch funnels.
Not in those words either.
No. You always pitched them head first, and lay them straight in the, so they go straight into the cylinder.
Did you ever put a fork in?
No. No, thank heaven. Never did. Another thing that's changed a lot was Dad used to grow corn, and he loved corn. He had an idea that corn had to be cultivated 6 times. 3 times this way and 3 times this way. And then after you finish the 6th time, and it was tackled, well, you had to get the fire tooth out and put the turnip seed in 2 tin cans on the handle with holes in the bottom of the can. Then you went to it and sowed turnip seed. And of course, that theory was the dust mulch. You just had to add dust mulch to hold the moisture. And I was raised on the dust mulch, and I found it awful hard. You come to this plow and plant, plow and not cultivate at all.
Yeah.
In fact, Steve wanted me to sell the old Super C, which is the only thing we got with a cultivator on it, and I said, well, wait till that year to come, if your weed killer don't work, yeah, cultivate, what are you going to do? But he's confident that'll never come. I did my first cultivating when I was 10 years old. I never weighed over 110 when I went to high school, so you can imagine, it looked like a flea up on the cultivator seat. Warren used to cultivate. That was my older brother. He had a habit of going to sleep.
Oh, boy.
And he'd dig out a row or two of corn, and Dad was very unhappy. And I did a good job, and that was a mistake, because Warren never had to cultivate after that, and I always did.
I was going to say that didn't pay to do too good a job, did it?
No. And our plowing was different for those days. We plowed the old 10-inch one-bottom plow. And while the horses was resting, you had the dung fork out there, and you spread the manure that you hauled out there with the dump horse and raked it off the manure fork. So that while the horses got to rest, you didn't.
Coming back to this thrashing deal, when they came to your place, you fed the thrashers yet?
Always.
Did you feed them at night or did you go home for supper?
Well, our outfit always went home for supper.
Which was a health food, they
were. Oh, yes, yes. But, of course, when they had the gang that went to the Whaley outfit, well, you had to feed them, both of you. They got their own breakfast, but you had to feed them too.
The individual home, when they were here, then your wife had to, or your mother, whatever case was, had to feed the whole gang.
That's
you
right.
Didn't bring in, it wasn't a potluck deal.
Oh, no. Each one put its own. Of course, some people got very adept at trying to arrange it so that they never were there for a meal. And,
that's where they
problems were. But that was kind of a stigma.
Yeah.
I don't remember anybody in our outfit, but we had one neighbor here that wasn't in the outfit. And his wife didn't like to cook, and she wasn't a very good cook. And you speak of putting the pork in, the boys finally decided that they would have a meal there. If they had to break down all day long. And they did. And the pie crust was a little bit
raw.
Well, no, it was hard.
Too hard.
But there were ways of getting even on everything. I don't know when that first tractor went out, we got a John Deere. That was still steel wheel. And as near as I can recall, we probably started that about 60 years ago. And it just naturally went out on the combine steamer. Can't think of anything else particularly on me.
Did you ever know your grandfather?
Yeah.
Did he ever tell you how they did it in the real early days? I wonder what. I just can hardly even imagine how they harvested it.
Well, of course, they did it with cradles. They had to. They didn't have anything else. But of course, you couldn't have a very big field to get it done. And, once again, there was the same old competition, you know, who could cradle the most in a day, who could do the nicest job. Those fellows got to be hardest with their size. And never forget the story that Grandma had a tree out here south of the house. She was saving. So when Granddad went out to cut, why, he was an expert with that old scythe, and he was, of course, you didn't have lawnmowers, you know, this was the way you cut the grass. You know, you got a pretty good scythe, and you went out there with a sharp scythe. And, of course, Grandma went out to preserve her tree. And Grandpa was going to catch that last blade of grass between the trees. And he miscalculated. He cut the tree. He never did hear the last of that.
Were you in the straw stacker here, or what did you do?
Well, we blew a lot of straw in the barn. That was all the horse feed. And that is the oat straw. This was back in the days before they learned how to treat the smut. And you come out of those barns blacker than any nigger you ever saw. In fact, some of the barns I worked in where you just had to feel all the time. And they'd really pay you 50, 75 cents extra if you worked on the straw. And today I couldn't do it. But Some days I used to.
No, Steve, we had quite a few little things.
Pretty little covers.
Yeah, it was very well. Here's one thing we're going to ask you about. If you remembered what you did for ice back in those days, did you put up ice yourself, or how was it?
About ice, I don't remember ever having any ice box. Now the milk earlier used to be separated by putting it in pans and posts down the cellar that supported the beams had slats across. Every 5 inches was a slat, and slid those pans in there. And then after we got away from the pans, we had the old water separator. And you just didn't milk out the bottom. When we finally got the cream separator, that was something. We had an old Eval cream separator. We had it in barn there. I mean, in the little room right there that we use for utility room now. And that would usually start about 10 o'clock at night because we never started to do chores until it was dark. And by the time we got the chores done, it was usually about 11 o'clock at night. And I always had to take the skim milk, the warm skim milk out, and feed it to the hogs after you run the separator. I can remember Dad used to take and drink a pint of that 40% butter fat cream.
Oh my.
Drink it right down. I don't know how he could do it.
What'd you do with the cream?
We took it down and had a station. Roy Baker had a station downtown here. And of course, depending on how many calories you had and how well it did, sometimes it got a little moldy, a little frothy, but nobody ever objected to taking it, and it seemed to make
butter.
Good butter. And there wasn't any big holler about sweet cream butter those days. It was all sour cream butter. But that was on Railroad Street down there, where that Roy Baker ran that for years. Then they used to, after that, McDonald had a milk route. They took milk in 10-gallon cans. This was later on, and you run two old white horses, pull that dray like a bear, took the milk in. Then, when they got trucks, well, as Dean used to come around with a truck that he was hauling milk for a long while, and he'd cool it out there in the windmill. I had to always just have an argument with the milk inspector. But I never believed him. I won't say argument because I didn't argue with him, but he said, "When are you going to seal this up?" Well, I just haven't got around. Of course, didn't have the money, couldn't. But the water, the well was deep, 80-some feet, and the water was cold, and we got by just cooling to the tub. I don't think we got by much longer if we hadn't quit milking cows because they were beginning to get real fussy about it.
Is that Dean who's been going? That would that be Dale Dean's father?
Dale Dean's father.
And Dale actually hauled milk for a while.
Isn't yeah.
I remember years ago. Ralph.
Yeah, I always had the Deans for one of my best insurance customers. Incidentally, this would be my 45th year in the insurance business.
That's a real landmark. My God. Were you always in coal water?
Yeah. Well, the first year I was up over one of the stores in town.
I didn't know that.
That was the least heat that I ever used, because they had a bakery underneath, and he had departments on both sides, and we had an oil stove there, and it took practically no fuel at all to keep us warm. Then we moved out here, and I decided that we should have an office in town. And I mentioned it to the district agent and the state director, and they said I was crazy. We didn't need any such thing, and they didn't prevail on me. I still put in an office on North Monroe Street up over Kleindienst Print Shop was the first one. And Hamden Bottling was on one side, Kleindienst Print Shop on the other, and I was one of the offices upstairs. And we made several moves, but we never moved over a block at a time. We're always on Monroe Street. We were just off of Monroe on Pearl there when the bank tore that building down. Swan, the old Jay Swan, had the print shop. He built that building for the Shopper's Guide and I. And then he sold it to the bank and they tore it down.
You mentioned something about dairy testing.
Oh, that's right.
1922,
you said, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, they had back in those days, it was a little different than it is now, but not so much different, I guess. They needed a job, and there was an opening in Eaton County, in the West Eaton Association. And I remember full well, they had a meeting there that I was supposed to go to that night. And I carved cabbage all day. I used to raise cabbage, and then sold the crop factory first. And the crop factory went under, we shipped this cargo of cabbage to Fort Wayne. And I carved cabbage all day, and then got in the old Model T and drove to Charlotte, which was farther than it is now. Went to the meeting, and I hired out. That was when Hans Gardell was in the South Association. He later became the county agent.
Eaton County.
The only county agent that I know of that ever got to be county agent without a college degree. And Hans he was a great guy. I always remember the story he told me. I like to hear him talk because he had he was kind of broken English. And I asked him what a man had to do in Denmark in order to draw a man's wages. Man said, well, he had to shoulder a bag of wheat and carry it up the stairway. And I said, well, there's bags of wheat and bags of wheat. How much did your bag of wheat weigh? He said, 190 pounds. And I said, I never would be a man. Oh, Hans said, yes, you would. Well, I said, but Hans, I'm not 6'6", and I don't weigh 225. He said, that's all right. Did you ever put the two sticks under the same load and stand them up? Same distance through. He said, the long one always breaks first. He said, the short fella goes right up the stairway and the tall fella's knees buckle and he falls downstairs. But I never forgot that.
How long did you work at Preston?
About 3 years. And then I bought the 6 cows out of the High Herding Association from Claire Fig in Vermont there. And I paid him, as I remember, $1,500 for the 6 registered Holstein cows. And I tried to borrow the money at the bank. And I told them I would give them 3/4 of the milk checks until the cows were paid for. And they wouldn't consider it. So I gave up the deal. And then they called me up one day and said they could do it. Of course, I didn't know the reason they said they'd do it. Was my aunt had called up and said that she would sign the note. If I'd known it, I wouldn't bought the cows. But then I lost the best cow from Bull on the Alfalfa. But the other 5, in 16 months, 3/4 of the milk check paid for the cow.
Remarkable.
And nowadays, the banks would be glad to have a deal like that. But back in those days, that was new.
Where did you took the milk sample, you weighed it, the farm, and where did you do the testing?
Right in the kitchen. Every place you went, you had a Babcock, an old Frank tester, and you set it up on the kitchen table and tested your butterfat. Of course, we had some pretty good sized herds of cows back then. Once on Vermontville, had 45 head.
You were hand milking.
Hand milking. 3 of them. Each one had 15 cows to milk. It's surprising how fast they went down through the line, though. And there was 2, 3, about 4 out of the 30 farms in the group that had milkers. And one of them was one of these that you sit on the stool between the 2 cows and work your feet back and forth.
Get never sucked. Wrong, did you?
See your hand, you use your feet.
You use your feet, yeah.
Never wrong.
But sanitation was what it is now. Cleanest herd in the association I had was in Bellevue. And that was the hardest work because he had a herd of registered Holsteins, and they were, some of them were on 3 times a day milking, some of them were on 4 times a day milking. So
man,
you had to take samples all times a day. And he had an aerator. That's the first aerator I ever saw. One of these that put the milk in the tank at the top and it ran down over a bunch of coils.
Water through the coils.
And water through the coils.
Yeah.
And that was the first aerator I ever saw. He furnished milk for Bellevue's Market, along with another fellow. But the other fellow ran him out of business because he had to create a cream line.
Really, probably.
And the other fellow was, he was the sloppiest. His barnyard was knee-deep all the time, and the cows had to run through it, and the milkers were wet hand milkers. And
just trying to know what you mean by wet hand milkers.
Yeah, I've seen them do it.
The strainers that we used in those days, we bought our sugar, you know, in 25-pound sacks. They were cloth sacks. And they'd take those and put them in the milk can, tie a string around the top. And that was the strainer. And it. This one place, the strainer would get full before the can did.
I know what you mean.
So they would untie the string, raise the sack up, and take his hand with the green slime going out from it, and squeeze the milk down through the strainer and put it back on. That opened it up so that it would take some more milk. But he ran the other fellow right out of business because of his cream line on the can.
So you did the computation and all, and told the guy whether the color
was
any good or not.
Did all the figuring at the at places and told him which cows was making the most money. Incidentally, I had the guy I heard in the association there was a fellow that had never drained his cows. He had some huge shorthorn cows. He had the best grade of alfalfa hay, one of the first ones to get alfalfa hay, and good acreage. And I had to work like a dickens to get him to beat any grain. He never had, and didn't see why he should. He finally did feed some, but he showed by far the most return for dollars for expended for feed of anybody in the association, year after year, because the capacity consumed huge amounts of roughage. But you had to stay in a different house every night. Some places treated you like a king, and others put you up in the attic where you're down there froze to death. And you had to be awful careful if that leg of that castor slipped off the kitchen table and you sprayed the acid around the kitchen. It wasn't too good. And we carried our acid in a pasteboard box with a little excelsior in it, glass jar right in the center. And we did that. We never thought anything of it until one of the fellows got in a wreck, and he was blinded for life. The fact is, he nearly lost his life from the burns and the acid. And then they began to think about it might be a little bit dangerous.
Were you married at that time when you did that?
Oh, heck no.
You were just out of school.
Just out of school. I was out of school in 1919.
You were getting some good experience, or getting experience at least.
My first job when I got out of school was shoveling coal at the co-ops down there. 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And you were getting a few hopper cars, but most of them were gondolas. You had to shovel them over the top. And they hadn't thought of dump trucks. They hadn't thought of elevators. You had to shovel that. Of course, the worst job was getting down to the bottom so you could shovel. You had to go clear down there 6-8 feet to get to the bottom before you could get any place to shovel from. And if two fellas couldn't unload a 60-ton car in a day, they hired somebody else.
How's that sound to you?
It's like carrying 190 pounds a week.
But that was it. We dumped it in the yard. I say dumped it, we had to shovel it off in the truck into the yard and then pick it up from the yard and deliver it wherever they wanted it. But after that, I got as high as $12 a week. And then on weekends, in the peach season, they wanted us to go to Benton Harbor and get a load of peaches. Those open Model T trucks.
That's quite a drive, 100 miles.
We'd get up there about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, lay down under a tree and sleep for an hour or two, go out in the peach orchard and hunt up some peaches, and buy them and bring them back to sell.
This is only just one question, Mr. Jerry Erd Tustin. Is Ace Balzer in the picture of you?
Yeah.
He's the one who kind of pioneered this testing the old mystery, right?
Yeah. That was another thing. The reason I got my job was I had taken a 16-week short course up to Michigan State. But I didn't have any money, so I never bought any books. I'd get by on my classroom work all right. Because the fellas in 16 weeks, they didn't learn all your names. They'd say the first two rows, get up and put your proposition on the board. If I happened to sit in the first two rows, I'd go back to the next two. I sat down when the instructor wasn't looking. But of course, the thing caught up with me when I went to take my exam. Balzer gave the exam for McKell testing. And they'd give you a 1,200-pound cow consuming so much roughage and so on and so forth. If I didn't have a heck of a time figuring that out, I finally got it right, but it was just from seeing the other fellas do it on the board, I never had figured out a ratio before. But I got by. You fellas didn't want to know something about the telephone company too, did you?
Right.
Maybe you aren't ready for that. Do you have any more questions on the Our old telephone company, of course you could appreciate that. I could show you a couple of the old telephones out in the barn. But they were the battery operated, Geisel, two Geisel, old Frank phones, one line, not two. The ground was your other.
How many on the line? How many in the party?
Well, all of us.
Oh, someone?
Yeah, there was about 14 of us on one line. Of course, everybody had a different ring. Our ring, I can always remember, was a long, too short, and a long. And
didn't it go any place? Just went between you, or did it go to town too?
Well, if you wanted to call it town, you just made one long ring.
You were connected to
it. You did the switchboard. Yeah. So at the end of the month, you had to pay your switch fees. The switch fees were charged to the association, and then the secretary of the association went around and collected the switch fees from the 14 people. If the line went down in a nice storm, we went out and cut our own pole, usually black ash. I can still remember we were working in a swampy area where the black ash was doing pretty good, but it was frozen over kind of honeycomb. And those black ash poles, green black ash poles, are heavy. And we were walking out of there with one on each end of the pole. And old I.B. Gilbert down here came out with one balanced on his shoulder, sinking in pretty near to his knees every step, but he showed us how strong he was anyway. I don't think there's another man in the association that could have done it. But we had our tree trimmers. We had our fellas that had these climbers for climbing poles. We had our ladders. The biggest trouble was trying to collect fees and collect them on time. I can remember telling one fellow that if he didn't pay his switch fees, it was going to cut him off. And he said, if you climb that pole, that's what you had to do to cut him off.
Yeah, all right.
I'll be out there with a shotgun. And I said, so you better shoot good the first time, because you ain't never going to get off another one. But we had a lot of trouble, but of course the most trouble was that you had people that wanted to listen in all the time. They knew everything that was going on in the neighborhood. But by the time you got two or three receivers off the hook, you couldn't hear anything.
The grounded line especially.
Yeah, it was.
Well, there were other lines coming in to Quincy or other than yours, didn't the Sunday switchboard?
Yes. See, they used to have switchboard in Quincy. They had another one in Allegancy. They had these little switchboards all over. Allen had their switchboard all the way around.
And how would you call, say, somebody down in California town? Could you call anybody down there?
Yeah.
You call into Quincy and put it through the long distance call? Or
the operator handled it. I don't remember how far it had to go before it was a long distance call, but it wasn't very far. But we always depended on the operator for everything. If you needed help, you call the operator too.
Since I've been here, I called Leo Sanderson and Allen, and that gal could tell you whether he was home or not.
Yeah.
Well, he's out of the Allen exchange. Yeah.
Incidentally, this party line business, general alarm. You any comment on that?
Yeah, whenever there was a fire or anything of that kind where they needed help, where the general alarm went out, and you never saw how fast people could congregate. Everybody started to. I know I had a fire here once, and called the fire department, and I went out to try and put out the fire, and they couldn't put it out, and I got all the animals out of the barn except the sow and the pigs. When the fire department came in, and by that time there was enough help. Of course, all my barns are hooked together. And the smoke was coming out of all four of them, and nobody. But I knew where the fire was. I had to. And the smoke was so thick, if it hadn't been a lot of people, one would follow the hose in and hang on to the nozzle as long as he could stand it, and then come out, and somebody else took his place. They put the fire out with no damage to the building. Maybe.
That's a real story, isn't it?
Well, did this general alarm, did they ever send out any messages other than the fire?
If this is something of general interest, I don't remember if somebody needed help. They tried to hold it to emergencies, either a fire or somebody needed help, something of that kind. And as you say, they telephoned the switchboard operator. Knew everything. What was going on.
And she rang everybody on the line and told them that Dobson's had a fire, right?
Yep. And
what was your signal? You had a signal that...
just one continuous long ring.
And everybody listened.
It just rang.
But to know where to go, you picked up the...
You picked it up and asked. And then every so often she'd tell you where to go. I know one of my classmates was a night operator. Tom Strauss was a night operator. And the guys used to drive him nuts. His own classmates, of course, calling up his night. And this was Tom's sleeping time. He would sleep on a cot there. And of course, when he didn't get very many calls at night, but when you got one, well,
got up and asked.
You had to get up and answer it. And those poor guys would get Tom up. Tacky, we call him. And the poor fellow wouldn't get any sleep. It was kind of rough. Pretty rough. Another thing that we used to have was at least every 2 weeks, the whole community got together at the local schoolhouse.
What district would this be out of?
This is the old Dobson District number 6. And everybody had to have a poem or a current event or something to add to the program. And, of course, we brought in food and we ate. I know one night I was particularly disturbed because my brother, who was great hand to recite poetry and knew a lot of poems, started to give a poem that was, well, it wasn't funny, it was a serious poem. And my aunt Nell and Neil Potter were laughing all the time, and I was quite incensed. And I found out why when they asked Aunt Nell for her program. Warren, who knew dozens of poems and couldn't give them any of them, had given the one that Aunt Nell had taken a month to learn.
I thought it was going on.
We used to have our own...
Can't hear it.
Own ball teams.
It messes up.
It was as high as 40 attended the one-room school. One teacher handled all the grades.
You went there for your 8 years, right?
Yeah.
Who were some of the teachers, if you remember? Any names that...
Still around?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Faith Spangler was one of them. One lived south of town. He doesn't have school outdoors. He had a bugle that he would stick out the window and he'd call into class. And he saw the county school commissioner. Horse coming over the hill. Believe me, he blew the bugle long and loud. But the old schoolhouse, the old Dobson School, was moved. One or two, when they needed extra room down to Quincy High School, they moved two up and down there. And Linus Hayden will dispute this, but our old school is at the west end of Jefferson Street in Quincy, being used as a church.
Is that right? West end of Jefferson, yeah.
He'll insist that that's the Alganti School, but
Well, when you were in the eighth grade, did you have to take the county eighth grade exam to go to high school?
Yeah, you in the seventh grade you took physiology and geography. In the eighth grade you took the rest of subjects. And I went up to take my seventh grade exam, and I don't know whether I sat in the wrong place or somebody made a mistake or something, but they brought me the eighth grade exam.
Oh my.
And I took it and passed it. And of course I was knee-high to a grasshopper, and Dad said I couldn't go to high school. And my older sister intervened, and I did go, which accounts for the fact that I got out of high school when I was 16. But
you never went to the eighth grade then in the world.
No. But you'd heard the eighth grade recite.
Yeah, that's right.
All these years.
Yeah.
I recently ran into the eighth grade exam.